Brian Noonan on 720 WGN, once again firmly ensconced in the Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Big show planned as always. It's always more fun, though, when you are involved. 312-981-7200. That's the number. When you call in, you'll be talking to Cody. No, there's no such thing as a seven-day itch golf. He's the executive producer from Rockford, Illinois. If you're nice to him, you get to me. You can also text us at that same number. And if you're a fan of social media, keep in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. It's Brian Noonan Show on both of those platforms. Roger, I apologize for the Orion stuff. I haven't been here in a while.
Yeah.
And somebody, for a reason that has not been explained to us, changed one of the input. This is very behind baseball. Changed one of the inputs on the board.
Oh, okay.
And so there's absolutely no reason for what happened to have happened, and yet it did. And only my quick thinking figured it out.
You were like,
well,
that.
No. Well, I was very upset. Right, but we couldn't. Well, at first I wasn't sure that
it was coming from me,
yeah. That it was coming from somewhere else. So, but it seems to all be fixed, so I apologize for that.
No apologies.
Hey, listen to Orion tomorrow morning. He's always working.
That's right.
The guy's nonstop. So, real quick, at 6:30, we're going to have our friends from the Mac and Cheese Festival stop by. That's coming up next Saturday at the UIC Pavilion, UIC, the Mac and Cheese Fest. We are going to talk. This is going to be very exciting and very, very interesting. After 7 o'clock, we're going to talk to Daryl Davis. His title is Unorthodox Racial Conversationalist. He is a race relations expert. He is going to be one of the speakers at TEDx Naperville, and his story is fascinating. So we'll be talking to him after 7 o'clock. Karen Conti will be here after 8 o'clock to answer all of your legal questions. We've got, we're going to talk a little bit about, of course we are, the big nuptials, but just real quick, why I was not here last week. I tried to keep the show page fully posted on Facebook to let you know. I didn't give all the details because, you know, I like to save the stories for here. But long story short, because we have a lot of things to get to on the program tonight, long story short, last Sunday I was admitted to the hospital, and last Monday they took out my gallbladder. I did not know I had a gallbladder issue. If you remember, about last month, end of September, I talked about going into the emergency room and the pain I was in. Well, that happened again last Sunday morning, and I went back to the emergency room, and this time they decided to do an ultrasound, and that's when they found a gallbladder full of stones, and I was told after the gallbladder was removed that, this was chronic. You probably had a problem with this for a long time, didn't you? And I was like, I don't know, because pain, unless the pain was crippling like it was a few weeks ago and last Sunday, I don't really pay attention to it, and most of us kind of go, all right, well, I got a little stomach ache, I'll move on. So that's where I was. I got I had surgery late Monday. I got home late Tuesday. And for those of you wondering and chastising me for being here tonight, I followed the doctor's orders to the letter. He said, listen, the next couple days, take it easy. So I got home late Tuesday, went right to the big chair, didn't even take a shower till Wednesday. Fine, I know. I haven't shaved in over a week.
I know.
My wife told me I have to shave because I look very old with this beard.
You haven't grown it out yet. Tell her to give her time.
No, it's a week out and it's completely white and I look like a grandfather. No offense, Roger. I know you have a completely white beard. But anyway, so Tuesday night, Wednesday, Thursday, I did nothing but sit in the big chair and relax. And the weirdest, and I couldn't even really eat because, one, I'm in pain. Two, you know, if you've had surgery, you're not really hungry, right? You know, you don't really feel like eating. The one thing I craved, and I don't know why, a regular hamburger from McDonald's.
Really?
Now, I can count on one hand the amount of times I've been to McDonald's in the last 6 years since I started losing weight.
Right.
For some reason, that's all that sounded good to me.
Wow.
So Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, all I ate all day were two regular hamburgers from McDonald's.
You did have them.
I did have them.
Oh, God bless.
Debbie was like, is there anything you have a taste for? I was like, yeah, it sounds weird, but I don't want I don't want anything but the hamburger.
Uh-huh.
And not just the regular old hamburger, not a cheeseburger, nothing.
Well, you had to wash it down with something, would you?
I had either 7-Up or water.
Okay.
That was what not I drank. Bad. Couldn't even drink my coffee in the morning, you know?
It was like,
so, but anyway.
You're on the mend
now. The long
and
the short of it is. Yeah. I'm feeling a whole lot better. I'm going back to school tomorrow.
Whoa.
Yeah, we'll see how that works out. but I have to be ready because we go to New Orleans on Thursday. So I've got follow-ups with the doctor and my regular doctor and the surgeon this week. But everything went well. Of course, they scare the hell out of you beforehand, telling you everything that could go wrong with the surgery. Oh. But don't worry. We do this tons of times every day.
Yeah.
But just in case, we want you to know, here's the deal. We're planning on doing it laparoscopically with the four little incisions.
Mm-hmm.
But if something goes wrong, we may have to cut you open and I might have to reach inside. And I'm like, okay, you know what? I know legally you probably have to tell me all this, but don't. I want to give a shout out to my nurses, Judy and Aaron over at the hospital. They did a great job helping me out during the day and at night because I was able to get up. This is another thing with me. No matter how much pain I was in or how sick I was not going to use one of those urinals. I was like, I'm getting up.
Yeah.
You sure? Yep, I'm getting up. Okay. So they would, instead of letting me just drag the IV cart into the bathroom with me, they would have to come in and unhook me. Then they'd have to come back in and hook me. They didn't seem to mind. And
they do it all the time.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Did you keep the night nurses company? Did you stroll out there and chat a little bit? Or?
What are you, high? I was on so much Dilaudid. this was the... and what was the Prohypnol? What's the one that Michael Jackson OD'd on? I think it was Prohypnol.
I don't know.
Something like that. They gave me that first.
Oh,
man, that stuff will mess you up.
Yeah.
And that Dilaudid. They'd shoot it in my IV, and I was sitting up straight in bed, and I could feel my face and everything droop, and I couldn't do anything about it. Yeah. I just sat there like, So
that must have been what they gave me when I went in for my one and only kidney stone.
Yeah.
I was in such pain. I was screaming, the whole shebang, and after about half an hour, they finally got me into a room, the emergency room, and they said, we're going to give you something for pain. And I had an IV, and it looked like that. I was
propofol,
going crazy.
That's what it is, propofol.
So they gave me a shot of something, and this is how I sounded. So how long will it take to work?
Yeah.
That was it?
Whenever they gave me to knock me out for surgery, I was gone. And I just remember coming to and them trying to hold my arms down because I was waving my arms around.
After you woke up,
and they're Mr. Noonan, put your arms down. Anyway, so the long and the short of it is, thank you for all your concern. I appreciate it. Thank you, Roger and Cody, for checking in on me all through the week. I made it through the wedding. That was the key component. The wedding was done and out of the way. We're going to talk about that in a second. So thank you there. Thank you, everybody at the hospital, McNeil Hospital, who took care of me, and my wife, of course. And so it was, this was my first big surgery. You know, I've had throat surgery and knee surgery and stuff like that. But this was the first where they intubated me, put the tube down my throat. And that's the moneymaker right here.
Yeah.
Oh, man. From the shoulders up.
Yeah.
That's gone. Forget it. So they didn't nick anything down there. The surgeon, Dr. Yang, didn't nick anything when he had 87 cameras in my belly. So good for him.
So this is the only body part you're missing now.
Well, my mind, some would argue. Good portion of my mind, and now my gallbladder. So we're checking them off. They're harvesting me piece by piece. The healthier I get, the worse health I'm in. It's a conundrum. All right, let's do this, and then we got to talk about Cody got married, y'all.
Yeah.
Oh, he got hitched up. So we'll talk a little bit about that on the other side. It's WGN. I will preface what we're going to talk about now by telling you that we will be recording a extended podcast. It's that season again, ladies and gentlemen. The Blackhawks have decided, you know what? We could play any night of the week, but we really love to play on Sunday nights. And we love the Blackhawks, but it is that time where we're going to be preempted a lot. Starting the next 2 weeks, we'll be off, but have no fear. We always love to create new content, so we will be recording an extended, internet-only podcast, broadcast, fistcast, because we do it with, Senior Wences puppets as well, talking all about the wedding. We're going to get into a lot more detail of the wedding, so keep posted at WGNRadio.com and the Brian Noonan Show page on Facebook and at WGNRadio.com, and you'll hear the where we're not interrupted by nothing. We can say whatever we want. So last Friday, October 20th, year of our Lord 2017, Cody and now Dr. Mrs. Cody's wife tied the knot. Roger was there. Cody, of course, was there. First of all, I don't know who made a deal with the devil for you, Cody. On October 20th, in Chicago, it's not supposed to be 76 degrees and sunny as we stand on the lake at 5 p.m. You're going to have to you're on out here. Oh, hold on.
I'm on here. Oh,
no,
there we...
it's the same issue with the other guy.
Someone messed with the screen in here, too. Someone just came in, just tried to sabotage
the show. Yeah, they
got to
find out who was in here. It's Fontana's.
I'm not happy. So we actually sold your soul. That's why you had the surgery.
Is that right?
Sorry about that.
Wow. So somebody had to pay, and I was the one?
76.
It was unbelievable.
It was perfect.
The skyline in the background set the scene for everybody. Where you got married? Where?
Yeah, we got married. The ceremony took place down at Promontory Point, right in Hyde Park.
Yeah, we'll get into that more on the podcast.
Yeah,
that was convenient.
Yeah, very convenient. Right by University of Chicago, and it kind of juts out. If you've never been down there, it is gorgeous. You got to go. You can see the entire Chicago skyline from afar, and it's just great. It's around 5,000 South Lakeshore ish.
Yeah, right, like 55th Street.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was just there's a building there, and the capacity would have held about the full wedding party.
Yeah.
But our contingency plan for if there was bad weather, because we planned on October 20th, we planned this in like March.
Right.
I had a good feeling. I had a feeling we'd be able to do it outside. And everybody, you know, especially my now wife, was just like, I don't know, October, late October, you never know. But there we were, had the chairs set up outside, and in the pictures, we don't have them all back, but, I mean, Brian is standing 10 feet away from the lake.
Yeah, it was really nice.
We were on the lake, and, you know, my wife and I right in front, the chairs just right in front of us, so it was pretty much perfect.
It was.
And even the traffic getting back, so then we had the wedding reception at the Congress mm-hmm. Plaza Hotel and Convention Center. I want to give a shout-out to Ruthie Howard, the catering manager, and LaToya Williams, the convention services manager. They were awesome to work with.
Cool.
They answered the thousands of questions that my wife and I and my mother had about the logistics and every little piece of minutia. They fixed any problems that arose, and it was awesome. I highly recommend the Congress. No, I'm not paid to say that. Wish I was all the time. but even the traffic was good, getting back up to the Congress.
I know
it. It was like we were back from 5,000 Lakeshore, and our ceremony was at 5 p.m. on a Friday.
Yeah, and we started a few minutes late.
Started a couple minutes late, but we were back at the Congress probably 20 minutes later.
Yeah.
20, 25 at the most. And this is coming from 5,000 Lakeshore to 500 South Michigan.
I got to give a shout out to somebody who works for the Park District who was in that building, because they gave us a tip because, you know, everybody left and everybody was trying to get an Uber.
Yeah.
And they're all just putting in Promontory Point. And they're all lingering around at the mouth of the tunnel there.
Yeah.
They had said, put the address as Bar Louie, which is right across the street. Have them pick you up at Bar Louie. By the time we cleared the tunnel across the street, there was our Uber. Boom. We were back.
Yeah,
Back in the bar at the hotel. And
you guys beat us. We were parked in that lot there.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, I don't mess around, Roger. I'm an efficient. I don't know if you know that. I'm a minister.
And I will say, and I told you this off the air, but I'm going to say it. There dozens of people came up to me and said that it was not only, I mean, the wedding reception was...
The reception was great.
Unbelievably fun. But not only that, but it was the best wedding they had ever been to. Oh. My friend Price was like, yo, man, I got a big family, but I've been to 19 weddings. the most fun wedding I've ever been to and the most fun ceremony I've ever been to. So much, I mean, everything Brian did was... Everything you said was perfect.
Oh.
We'll try to get some audio for the podcast in the next few weeks. We had a couple amazing photographers, Palette of Light Photography and Film. They're actually out of Rockford, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Aaron and Lindsay at Palette of Light were awesome. And we paid a little extra for video of the ceremony. So
nice.
We'll have some video with some audio. They mic'd us up and everything, and we'll try to get that.
Yeah.
Of course, they're very, very busy. So, ooh. Roger's...
Roger feeling very left out that he doesn't have, he's not part of the story yet, so he's jumping in with some music.
This is our first dance. We chose Blue Skies.
It was very nice.
I couldn't get Africa by Toto.
But you did play it.
We did play it.
You did play it.
We did play it during dinner. But we can go into more detail about everything on the podcast, which I'll post next Sunday at the usual showtime.
Right.
So you can watch the Blackhawks on TV and listen to the Brian Noonan Show podcast.
Between periods or if you, listen to John and Troy with all the action and then listen to us during the breaks. Roger was there with his wife Bridget and Karen was there.
In fact, we drove Karen back. We drove them back with us.
Didn't offer me a ride.
It was... Yeah. Shocking how perfectly everything went.
It did. Everything was very smooth, save for one detail at the wedding, which we'll talk about on Tuesday. One technical detail had nothing to do with the bridal party or the anybody there. It was just a technical detail. But as we do with this program, we rolled with it.
We did.
And the bride looked beautiful, and the groom looked very handsome in his midnight blue tuxedo. Could have gone right to a gig for an after-hour lounge singing somewhere. Your hair was incredibly high. I'm not going to lie. It was disturbingly high.
It was very Cody.
Yeah, it was way, way coiffed up, and it did not move.
I hairsprayed it. Nice. I didn't want
it
to move.
You shellacked it.
I actually showered twice that day because the first time I did my hair, it didn't come out the way I wanted. I was like, this isn't going to fly. I get one wedding.
You can't have a bad hair day on your wedding.
No.
It was lovely. Your family and your wife's family, everybody seemed to get along. There were no fist fights at the reception. Nobody seemed to be, there were people who were drinking, but nobody seemed to be out of hand.
Yeah, no.
It all seemed fun.
Even you and me.
Yeah, I know, I told you, I didn't think I was drunk at all until I finally left the reception. Because all of a sudden, this is weird, and then we got to get to the news. And I tell you this because normally if I'm consuming a lot of liquids, like most of us, I go to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom 5 minutes before the ceremony, so at 5 to 5. I didn't go again till we left the reception at 12:35. And it was at that moment, maybe all the fluid was keeping me balanced. And once I went to the bathroom, I went, wow, I'm a little buzzed. And we got in the Uber, and thank God my wife handled navigation because I remember getting into construction somewhere on the Eisenhower, and the driver saying something, and then next thing, my wife was elbowing me, we're in front of the house. So, perfect.
Awesome.
Everything worked out. So, yes, we will be recording a huge podcast based on Cody's wedding. You can hear it next Sunday at 6 right here during the regular showtime. Go to WGNradio.com. We'll post links to it on the Facebook page and Twitter and all of that. On the other side of the news, we're going to talk about mac and cheese because it's getting cold out and you need some comfort food. So we'll give you some here on WGN. If you've only experienced mac and cheese from a blue box, you are completely missing out. For the fourth year, the Mac and Cheese Fest is returning to Chicago November 4th at the UIC Forum. It is a day of celebrating nothing but macaroni and cheese, and not just, again, the kind in the blue box or the red box, but no, top chefs from around the state are bringing in wonderful creations. In the studio with me, Melinda Joseph and Ozzie Mesa. They are co-founders of the Mac and Cheese Fest. Welcome, guys. Glad to have you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so, people eat mac and cheese all the time.
Yes.
It's one of those things we all grew up on. How do you decide at some point, you know what, we need a festival. There's not enough mac and cheese. We need to draw national attention to this.
Well, we're now in our fourth year, right? So 4 years ago, we decided that we needed something as cheesy as possible, right?
Right.
And, you know, everyone loves those cheesy jokes. And Mac and Cheese Fest is just one of those comfort foods that everyone loves and remembers when they're kids, right?
Well, it used to be you'd have it when you were a kid. Or if you weren't feeling it, you know, your mom would make it for you after school. You'd have it for lunch or dinner. But then it started popping up on menus, not only at, like, barbecue places, but at fine steakhouses. And everybody started putting their own twist on mac and cheese, you know?
Right. What's interesting is that the chefs get so creative, and there's just so many variations. They put jalapenos, or they put brisket, pulled pork, lobster. They get very creative with the dish that they can add so many ingredients in.
So now, how did the first year, you come up with this idea, and everybody's probably going, oh, that's a great idea. It's fantastic. And then you turn around, and they start laughing. They're like, really? How's this going to work out? So how has it grown, and how did you approach those chefs the first year and go, hey, listen, here's what we want to do. You want to bring some mac and cheese over?
Well, we've been producing events for years, from Taste of the Gold Coast to Taste of Streeterville, but those events are particularly to that neighborhood,
right,
particularly to those restaurants. So it was really exciting when we first launched to be able to invite any Chicagoland restaurant to be able to participate in challenging the chefs. But the really fun part is that we have an award element. So we give away the golden noodle,
yes,
which is gold-plated.
Very nice.
And we have runners-up and best presentation, most creative. And so the chefs really push themselves to be there 100%, give it their all, do something creative. They're proud of what they've done. A lot of the times it is something on their menu that they already do, and so they're really excited to kind of show off their mac and cheese from their restaurant.
And if somebody goes to Mac and Cheese Fest, one of the cool parts is they're actually voting on these, on the awards, so they have a stake in what's going on.
Yeah, so we have judges that are brought in, experts, to help judge who the best mac and cheese is. But every person that is there, every guest, gets a vote. They have one vote, so that vote is very, very important.
And how do you become an expert in mac and cheese? Are these other chefs? Are these people from Kraft? Who are they?
It's a combination of everything. We have social media influencers that are food experts. Okay. We have former Golden Noodle winners that are being part of that are judges as well. And then just culinary experts in Chicago.
Okay.
That teach how to, chefs how to become in the culinary arts, or that have culinary background and experience, because they are given specific guidelines in terms of taste, texture, flavor profile, mm-hmm. not just what do you like.
Right. Now, okay, so we all, like I said, everybody grew up with the easy mac and cheese. Mm-hmm. What have you seen as you go into the fourth year? What is the secret to win the Golden Noodle? Has there been some commonality of your winners up to this point, or has everybody been so different that you're like, there's no way to tell what people are going to like?
You know what? I think there's two things that really stand out. It's sweet and savory that really, really wins people's hearts.
Oh, is a combination?
Yes.
Yeah. So, for example, our first year, Kitty O'Shea's from the Hilton Chicago won, and they had like a caramel drizzled with caramelized onions with their
dish.
It was
amazing.
Had that sweet and savory profile. And one of the years we had a food truck win, Auntie V's, that did a mac and cheese bread pudding with like a vanilla drizzle. And it sounds like it might not all go together, but when you tasted it, you had that sweet and savory theme, and it was delicious.
Yeah.
Well, that's the genius of a lot of these chefs anyway. They put together things that most of us would go, that's never going to go together. How does that work? But they know, and they can present it. So is it more elaborate when people come in, and you can get your tickets if you go to Chicago or macandcheesechicago.com. You can get your tickets right now. There's regular and then there's VIP, and we'll explain what those are, and also that there's two different sessions. So you don't have to block out your whole day on November 4th. You block out either a lunch section from 12 to 3 or something in the evening from 6 to 9, the dinner section, and you're going to, and don't think, well, if I go to lunch, there's not going to be as many chefs. Oh, no, you would be way off, correct? Because there's going to be about 50 chefs at least in each session trying to win your vote for the Golden Noodle.
There is more cheese in one room than you can ever imagine. And if you think you're going to walk out hungry or thirsty, you have something coming to you, because it is the most amazing day.
as they've come in the last few years, are they shocked at the kind of things that the chefs have put into the mac and cheese? Just listening to you, Melinda, describe the bread pudding and some of the others, there's no way. That doesn't make any sense. How can that be?
Yeah, I think they sometimes don't know what to expect when they come for the first time. They know there's going to be a ton of mac and cheese and they're excited.
Right.
But then, you know, they get to, it's a challenge, because in order to vote, you really got to try and taste them all.
Yes.
You know, and if there's something you like, you can go back to a station, but we really want to push people to try every
and
restaurant.
50 restaurants is a lot of mac and cheese, even if it's a small tasting sample.
Right.
That's a lot of mac and cheese.
It's a lot of mac and cheese, but it's exciting for them.
Do you have cots in the lobby?
We have benches.
Okay, there's benches. That's good.
You know, got to pace yourself, take a break.
Sure.
We have dancing. You can dance. We have a great DJ. We have mascots. You can dance with the mascots.
I saw the mac and cheese mascots.
We have a photo booth. There's so much action and things you can burn some calories. It balances everything, right?
And we, of course, have beer, wine, spirit, cider to cleanse your palate in between tastings as well.
Well, let's talk about them. People can go to macandcheesechicago.com. What's the cost?
General admission is $65.
Okay.
That includes your entry, all you can taste, and 5 drink vouchers for all of the beer, wine, spirits, and cider.
That's pretty good. And you have a VIP package, because nobody wants to just go regular. They want to be VIPs. Everybody wants to be a VIP.
We've learned that VIP is very, very important.
Very important people.
So with VIP, you get access to a restricted area where you're able to sit down, enjoy your mac and cheese.
That's what I like.
You also get a commemorative Mac and Cheese Fest t-shirt that kind of looks like this, the one I'm wearing
right now.
You can't see it on the radio. It's very nice. And then you also get priority access into the fest.
See, and people want that. People don't want to go somewhere where there's not VIP. Because some people, even eating mac and cheese, they want to be, you know, away from the unwashed.
Well, aside from first entry and an area to sit and eat, You also leave with a shirt, so it's fun.
That's pretty cool. And again, this is November 4th at the UIC Forum. MacandCheeseChicago.com is the website. It's the 4th annual Mac and Cheese Fest. Melinda Joseph and Ozzie Mazar are here. They are the co-founders. We're going to get into who won last year because it was very exciting, and we'll talk more about the fest. We've got some mac and cheese from our good friend at Mastro's. We're going to talk about some other mac and cheese that will be there. And, you know, most of it, good old American mac and cheese. There's one interloper from across the pond, a German type of mac and cheese that I noticed. And it sounds actually very fascinating, too. So a lot more mac and cheese talk on the other side at 720 WGN. The studio is filled with all sorts of exotic mac and cheese, along with some butter cakes, all from Mastro's. Mastro's, one of the restaurants competing in the 4th annual Mac and Cheese Fest. And I say competing because while it is a celebration of mac and cheese, these restaurants aren't doing it just for grins. They want to win the golden noodle. Melinda Joseph and Ozzie Mazar are here. They are the co-founders of Mac and Cheese Fest. And as you mentioned earlier, Melinda, this is serious business for these chefs. This is not, hey, let's throw together an aluminum tin of some sort of backyard mac and cheese and go to a picnic. They're bringing the heat when they come here.
That's right.
Very nice. Who won last year? Because, again, you have a winner for each session, correct? The lunch session and the dinner session.
Correct.
So who won last year, Ozzie?
So last year for the lunch session, we had Rosebuds.
Ooh, they're a very nice place, Rosebuds.
Yes, they came with their A game and they knocked it out of the park. And then for...
What was their mac and cheese?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
Of course, I know.
Mac and cheese arancini balls?
Yeah, they did these mac and cheese balls.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm saying it right, but arancini balls, they were really amazing. And then amazing edible gourmet catering, one for the dinner session.
Very nice.
So, and I know you're going to ask me what they did made, and I can't remember.
Of course I am.
I can't remember off the
top
of my
head. That's my job to ask.
It's a very long description, but I know they're, it probably is like amazing mac and cheese.
All right, some really good mac and cheese.
Some amazing mac and cheese. But what's really cool about the fest, as we mentioned before, is that it brings, you know, restaurants, catering companies, food trucks, all together in one place. So, I mean, it levels the playing field.
Yeah, that's really cool because, you know, you mentioned the catering company and you mentioned Rosebud. Well, most of us have heard of Rosebud, but the catering company, we don't know unless we've hired them to cater an event.
Exactly.
We don't know. So who are some of the contestants this year? I know we've got Mastro's. We're going to talk a little bit about them and the wonderful stuff that they've got to offer because they competed last year as well, right?
Mastro's?
Did they?
Mastro's
is
new
first.
To the
yeah,
oh,
they're new.
Yeah.
Oh, very nice.
I mean, we'll rattle off some places. So we have Baptiste and Bottle. We have Amazing Edibles is coming back. We have Rosebud is coming back.
Rocket will be there.
Okay.
Seven.
We have Whisk.
Oh,
Son of a Butcher.
I saw
Kitty
Jerk
O'Shea's
that
is coming
the Jamaican
back.
Place is on
Jerk
there.
Jerk will be there, yep. Midnight Mac and Cheesery will be there, so I'm excited to see what they'll be doing because they are mac and cheese specialists.
That's their thing.
XO Marshmallow.
Wait a minute.
I know. It's a restaurant that specializes in marshmallows. And they're coming in and they're
I don't know a lot about cooking, Ozzie. I'm a fairly decent cook. Marshmallows and mac and cheese?
I have no idea how they're going to do it, but I know it has to have cheese and it has to have some sort of pasta flavor. So
you have to be there to experience it.
Yeah, well, please report back on me how this marshmallow place does because it seems a little dubious. But I'm sure, just like I would have thought the bread pudding was dubious, it's going to turn out wonderfully.
Mahoney's is actually doing a strawberry mac and cheese cake. I'm interested to see what they're doing with that.
Well, see, again, we have to change our minds, which brings us to some of the stuff I mentioned before, that there's a lot of good old American mac and cheese coming with a lot of different varieties. But there's a German mac and cheese being brought in by Boho House. It's a Kespetzel, I think I'm saying that right, with Gouda and Butterkäse cheeses. I don't know it. But it sounds, I read the description, I'm like, this sounds phenomenal. So as they're submitting to you guys and you're reading these descriptions, you're like, oh my God, I got to try this one first. I got to go here first.
We read the descriptions and some of them, like, just like what you said, like, it doesn't make sense. Like, written down just doesn't make sense. But when you go to the booth and you taste it, it blows your mind away. Just somehow they pull it off. And like the drizzle of caramel or vanilla on it. Like, that's how a lot of these restaurants are bringing their A game and it's going to be fabulous.
Well, I looked over at some of the stuff. Describe what these are. I'm wondering if these are what Mastro's are going to enter, or
yes.
are these, you know, they're kind of throwing us off. Here, try these, but we've got something really special saved up for
Mastro's
the fest.
Mastro's brought to the studio for you to taste today their entry, which is called the Ultimate Chicago-Style Mac and Cheese Dish. Mm. And it is a gorgonzola mac and cheese with their homemade jardiniere and signature steak bacon. That's what you're looking at right
there. Oh, my God. It's is it news time yet, Cody? Can we not to hustle you guys out of here? You can stay. That sounds phenomenal. The ultimate Chicago mac and cheese. So, gorgonzola cheese, hot jardiniera, their homemade jardiniera,
and steak bacon.
Mm-hmm. Steak bacon.
It says their signature steak bacon. So I'm
it
not...
sounds phenomenal.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So they're going to be there. And again, Chef Rita Anasiri. Is that correct?
Rita Nassar.
The chef at Mastro's, good luck to you with this. I'm sure you're going to do fine. Baptiste and Bottle, you mentioned they always have they have one with smoked cream cheese, American cheese, pimento cheese, and Wisconsin cheese. Then they put in chili, panko breadcrumbs, jalapenos. Has there ever been one that's come in, and I know you read these and you're amazed, one that you went, you couldn't possibly put one more ingredient in this mac and cheese. This mac and cheese is delicious. But seriously, there's a limit with how many things you can put in there.
Yeah, it's called what you can put on a website sometimes and still make it look good.
If it doesn't fit. You know, what we do at the fest is when you approach the booth high up above behind the table, not only does it have the name of the restaurant, but underneath it has a sign with the name of the dish and what's in it.
Okay.
So as people are walking past and looking at all the restaurants, you're also kind of being able to see what is in the dish as you're about to taste it, because it makes it that much more interesting to understand and know.
Not a restaurant. I'm not putting you on the spot for one of your competitors, but as a mac and cheese aficionado, which is the person people who've organized the fest for 4 years, we're going to put you in that category. Is there a type that you favor over others? And I'm not trying to throw the competition. You do not vote in the golden noodle, do you? Is there a cheese? Do you say, I like more of a cheddar-y, or I like a gouda, I like a gorgonzola, or I really like the sweet and savory? That's what I'm looking for.
You know what? I'm torn because the sweet and savory really surprises me. Like, I don't expect it.
Right.
But I feel like I'm the kind of guy that likes a really good classic cheddar mac and cheese.
Okay.
The cheesier, like I want, you know, that cheese pull, you know, you pull your fork into the dish and just pull the cheese
out. Right, the big strips
like,
of cheese.
Like, yeah, that's
out.
Exactly the kind of mac and cheese that I like.
Breadcrumbs? No breadcrumbs?
No, just plain
just
old good mac and
cheese.
But it has to be the right type of cheese or the right type of noodles, too. But just a good classic mac and cheese Lego.
Melinda, you panicked when I asked this question because I know you're thinking, he's going to make me talk bad about it. No, I'm not.
Well,
but everybody has a preference.
It depends which chefs are listening right now.
Well, that's why we're not, I'm not putting it as a type. We're just talking about, you know, in general, if you were going to eat it at home.
I think I'm more of a sweet and savory type of girl.
See, that doesn't alienate anyone.
But what's exciting?
Except all the chefs now going,
I mean, if you ask us who's our favorite.
We don't vote.
I didn't do that.
We don't vote. And this voting process, which takes place in Chicago, we're very proud to make it as fair as possible. You only vote once.
Is that right?
And it's not electronic. We do old school paper.
Is there punch cards? Will there be any chads hanging?
No. Nothing. We're very fair.
All right, very good.
Very, very fair.
So,
it's about the talent of the chefs.
Of course it's about the talent of the chefs. But everybody, you know, do you see it? Before we go, and if you see this, you should tell, you can name that chef. You see any peeling the cellophane off the American cheese slices and tossing it in there?
No.
Nobody's using
the
processed cheese food?
None of that.
No processed.
Mm-hmm.
This is all
this
real
is
cheese?
Gourmet.
All right. Good.
Mac and cheese.
Gourmet mac and cheese. And if you want to sample over 50 gourmet mac and cheeses and drink beautiful beer, wine, spirits, everything, and have a wonderful time, and have a hand in who will go home the winner of the Golden Noodle Award, you need to go to macandcheesechicago.com, because the 4th Annual Mac and Cheese Fest is coming this Saturday, November 4th. It's at the UIC Forum. You can buy tickets for the lunch session, which runs from noon to 3, or for the dinner session, which runs from 6 to 9. The general admission, you get to as much as you can taste. You get 5 drink tickets, and you get to come in. Sure, there's a VIP option, because we know you're a snob. You want to eat mac and cheese with your pinky up. Do that. Go, because then you get a T-shirt. You get early access. You get a special roped-off area, and nothing makes mac and cheese taste better than being behind a velvet rope.
And,
I'm not going to lie to you.
And a portion of the proceeds every year go to
Ronald McDonald House, which is a wonderful organization, and it's great that you guys are helping. Congratulations on 3 years. I'm sure the 4th year is going to be a wonderful success. Thank you guys for coming in. Melinda Joseph and Ozzy Meza are the co-founders of the Mac and Cheese Fest. Thanks to our good friends at Mastro's for sending over the ultimate Chicago mac and cheese, which we will dive into. Good luck to all the competitors, and may the Golden Noodle Champion reign supreme for a year. Two Golden Noodle Champs. We appreciate that. Mac and Cheese Fest, November 4th. It's macandcheesechicago.com. News next, WGN. The TEDx, if you remember a couple years ago, Cody was emceeing the TEDx event in Naperville. And TEDx, in case you don't know, you may be familiar with TED Talks, which happen every year in Vancouver. TEDx, those are smaller events, and they're created for communities to share ideas. The TED's mission is ideas worth spreading. TEDx is designed to give communities, organizations, and individuals the opportunity to create TED-like experiences locally and through their own events. So TEDx Naperville is happening November 10th at the Yellow Box Theater in Naperville. They're going to be more than 12 speakers or performers, 750 guests, 70 organizers, a lot of people coming, and a lot of people sharing wonderful ideas. And one of the speakers that jumped out at me was Daryl Davis. And if you haven't heard of Daryl Davis, he has a very fascinating story that he's going to share with us. But it was his title that first kind of caught my eye. Unorthodox Racial Conversationalist. And with that, I want to find out what that is, as I'm sure you do too. So I welcome Daryl Davis to the program. Daryl, thanks for taking some time tonight. Welcome. Oop. There we go. There you are, Daryl. Hello?
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming. Can you, what is an unorthodox racial conversationalist?
Well, that wasn't my title. Somebody assigned that to me.
Okay.
But I'm guessing it's a conversationalist who does not go by the status quo of having conversations with someone.
Well, and that would sum you up pretty good as a race relations expert, but that's not your whole story. You graduated from Howard with a degree in jazz. You've been playing piano, singing, playing guitar. You've been performing nationally with your own band, the Daryl Davis Band, but you've performed with Chuck Berry, the Jordanaires, the legendary blues band. You've toured all over the country, and somehow you started talking about race. Can you tell us about the incident in 1983, the encounter that led you down this path?
Yes, absolutely. In 1983, I was in a country western band, and I was the only black person in the band, and consequently, usually the only black person in many of the places in which we performed. And we were performing in a place called the Silver Dollar Lounge in a town called Frederick, Maryland. And everybody in there was white. Blacks could go in, but they did not go in by their own choice, and usually was a very good choice because they were not welcome.
Okay.
Well, here I was in the place, and I had just joined the band recently, and after the first set, I came off the bandstand and was walking to the table so with my bandmates on the break when a white gentleman came up from behind and put his arm around my shoulder and said, "I really enjoy your all's music." And I thanked him and shook his hand, and then he made the remark that this was the first time he'd ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. And I was not offended. I was rather surprised that he did not know the origin of Jerry Lee's
exactly.
style of playing.
So really, you've never heard of Little Richard or anybody like that, huh?
You know, I assume he never heard Little Richard or Fast Domino.
Exactly.
But I explained the black origin, you know, from the blues and Boogie Woogie, and he was incredulous. He did not believe it. And I explained to him, you know, I know Jerry Lee. You know, he's a friend of mine, and he's told me himself. He didn't believe that either. But he wanted to buy me a drink. And I don't drink, but I went back to his table and had a cranberry juice. And through the course of conversation, he revealed that this was also the first time they'd ever sat down with a black man and had a drink. And now I was really curious. You know, I just was not tuning in.
Right.
And I asked him why, and at first he did not answer me. And upon, you know, further asking why, he finally revealed that he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And I started laughing because I did not believe him. And he produced his Klan card from his wallet.
Oh, geez.
And I recognized, you know, the Ku Klux Klan insignia.
Sure.
It's a red circle, white cross, and blood drop in the center. And immediately I stopped laughing. But we continued the conversation. It was a very friendly conversation. And I was learning, and he was learning, and something, you know, we both did not know. But here we are, two people on opposite ends of the spectrum, brought together by music. And after that experience, I thought, you know, I need to explore this some more. I need to develop this. And I had an incident when I was a kid a very racist incident in which I had formed a question in my mind of how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Yeah.
And I had never been able to find the answer to that question. You know, the question was formed at the age of 10. So now in my adult life, when this happened, I later thought, well, you know what? There was my opportunity. Who better to ask for the answer to that question of how can you hate me when you don't even know me than to ask someone who would join an organization whose whole premise is hating those who do not look like them and who do not believe as they believe.
And did you ask this gentleman that question?
I most certainly did. And he didn't really have an answer for it. He told me that, you know, that he didn't hate me. But I wanted to get to the leader of the Klan.
Right.
And I had him provide me with the information, the contact information for this individual. And he provided it to me on the condition that I not reveal where I got it.
Well, sure.
And that's what started the whole ball rolling. I interviewed the leader and then ended up traveling around the country interviewing other Klan factions, their leaders and members.
And those interviews turned into a book, Clandestine Relationships. All right, so you make this decision and you have this question that's been troubling you, as I'm sure it's troubled thousands of other people from the time you were a young child. How can you hate me if you don't even know me? It's got to take an incredible amount of courage to go and sit across, not from this guy who approached you at the bar, because he approached you. He was obviously going to make friendly conversation. But now you're going into the lion's den, basically, with the leaders of these hate groups. How did those conversations come about? Because I'm guessing it had to be a difficult sell to go, hey, look,
well,
I'm Daryl Davis. I want to come and talk to you about this.
Well, you know, it was more curiosity than courage, because I've been seeking this answer, you know, for a number of years, decades, and he was unable to provide the answer, and ultimately no one was able to provide the answer, because the answer to the question of how can you hate me when you don't even know me is there is no answer.
Right.
There is no justifiable answer. And so I'm still doing that, you know, that kind of work. So it was not hard for me to sit across from these people, because I wanted to know what their mindset was. Where are they coming from? You know, they are no different than I am. I'm no different than they are. And, you know, in questioning them, I learned a lot about psychology, about sociology, about the, you know, the mindset. And that just, you know, gave me more information. So each time I approached a new Klan member, Klansman or Klanswoman, I was armed with information, and that, you know, worked on them. And over time, many of the ones that I would question would renounce their beliefs because they could not answer the question, and I ended up with their robes and hoods.
That's amazing. When you would make these requests to talk to these people, were you upfront about the fact that you were a black guy and say, hey, listen, here's why I want to sit down with you, or was it, Can I interview you about the Klan, and then you would show up and see how things went?
I'll put it this way. I did not deceive them.
Okay.
I did not make it a point to tell them that I was black. I had my white secretary call them.
Okay.
And I specifically told her, don't tell them I'm black unless they ask.
Ah, okay.
You know, let's not bring race into it. Let them determine, you know, if they are willing to sit down and talk. And then if they agree, of course, once they meet me, they'll figure that I'm black.
Sure, right.
You know, they'll see that.
And how were their reactions?
Influence, you know, their answers if they agreed to meet with me. That way, you know, they would have time to prepare. Would they provide a different answer for a black interviewer than they would give a white interviewer? And to me, you know, the truth is the truth.
Sure.
Whether you're talking to a white person or a black person.
Of course.
So I wanted these interviews to be spontaneous and candid. So she understood that. And, when you called me to ask me, you know, would I interview with you, you didn't say, hey, I'm a white guy.
Exactly.
Go on the radio with me. So, you know, that would be kind of, granted, you know, I'm not the Klan or something like
right.
that.
Well, but, yeah. See, it's a different story. You're coming on here. I'm not, you know, I haven't made a history of trying to lynch people.
My race.
Right.
You know, look at me first as a human being.
Right.
And sit down and talk to me and then determine, you know, if you don't like me.
Now, were there any times when you showed up for these interviews and, the Klan's people, you know, just decided, you know what, I'm not sitting down with this guy now.
Absolutely. You know, a Klansman, a Klanswoman is not stamped from a standard cookie cutter. They come from all walks of life, right, and all, you know, mental attitudes. So there were those who, after they got over the shock, oh, you know, this guy's a black. You know, they sat down and they talked and were very cooperative and cordial. Mm-hmm. And then there were those, you know, upon seeing me, no, I'm not going to talk to you. Go away. And then there were those who wanted to fight. So I've encountered, you know, all three types.
And you mentioned when you were talking to the first guy in the bar while you were playing in the band, he said he had never talked to a black person before. Did you find that to be...
He had never sat down and had a drink with a black person before.
Did you find that to be a common element with a lot of the people that you interviewed? That they had never sat down for a long conversation?
Well, yes and no. You know, our society is pretty diverse, and in many places, you know, these people have jobs. They have to work.
Sure.
So they even have to work with people that they hate, say Jews or blacks or Hispanics, Asians, et cetera, all non-Aryan, as they call them.
Yeah.
They have to work with those people, but they're there because they have to draw a paycheck, pay their mortgage, you know, pay their rent, put food on the table. But, you know, so yes, they talk to them on the job, or if they have to go to a store and they have a black salesperson waiting on them, yes, they talk to them. However, when he says, you know, I've never sat down and had a drink with a black guy, what he means is he's never socialized.
Sure.
When these guys get off work at 5 o'clock, they do not go to happy hour with someone outside of their race.
It's
so that was
amazing.
Common, yes.
And was there? You also mentioned that you learned a lot about the psychology. Were there a few common traits that would drive someone to be in the Klan? Was it all hereditary? Well, my grandfather and my father were in this, and that's what I am. Was there, did they have these beliefs as a child?
Hereditary, but yes, it was family tradition. Hereditary meaning, you know, it's genetic.
Okay.
But yes, oftentimes it was family tradition. You know, their grandfather was in the Klan, their daddy was in the Klan, so they're in the Klan, now their son's going to be in the Klan. There was that. There was also a socioeconomic thing, where they felt that, you know, they were out of a job and somebody else got the job who does not look like them. So, you know, the Klan comes along and says, hey, you know, you deserve this job. You know, sign up with us. The blacks have the NAACP. The Jews have the ADL. No one is standing up for the white man except the Klan. Come join us and we'll get your job back. So these are people who may never have been racist before in their lives. And they began thinking, you know what? You know, they got a point there. Here, give me an application. Sign me up. So there are all kinds of reasons. Or, you know, they might move into a town, into an area. Somebody moves into an area where, you know, it is saturated with that kind of mentality. So in order to get along in the area in which you live, you join, you know, the popular groups there. You know, the local bridge club, golf club, Ku Klux Klan club, you know, whatever.
Daryl Davis is my guest. He is a race relations expert. He is the author of Clandestine Relationships and the subject of the documentary Accidental Courtesy. He'll be appearing at TEDx Naperville, which takes place Friday, November 10th at the Yellow Box Theater in Naperville. If you go to TEDxNaperville.com, you can pick up your tickets. Daryl, can you hold on just a couple minutes?
Absolutely.
Terrific. More with Daryl on the other side. It's 720 WGN. Daryl Davis is my guest. He is the author of Clandestine Relationships. He is also the subject of the documentary Accidental Courtesy. My bad, I apologize. And he will be at the TEDx Naperville event Friday, November 10th at the Yellow Box Theater in Naperville. TEDxNaperville.com is where you get your tickets. Fascinating story so far, Daryl. I got to ask you about being the godfather for a former Imperial Wizard's granddaughter. As unbelievable as your story had been up to this point, how does that happen?
Well, it happened, the gentleman got married, and he left the Klan, and we talked about it, and it was agreed, you know, that I would be, but the wife's family had some issues with that.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, don't even worry about it, and you know, that was, you know, I never pursued it.
That's and the fact now, when these people that you met with would renounce the Klan, I'm guessing that has to be a big deal in the Klan world to walk away, is it? And what
yes,
would they
is.
What would they tell you were the reasons?
It's a big deal for several reasons. One, depending upon how they do it, they can receive threats from within. But also, you know, the stigma follows them around. And, you know, when they're in the Klan, society at large shuns them. because, you know, they're an outcast.
Sure.
But then when they leave the Klan, the Klan becomes their family when they join it. You know, that you know, those are their brothers and sisters.
Sure.
And so now they have abandoned and betrayed their family. So now they're shunned by their family, and the stigma of having been in the Klan lingers over them. So even society sometimes is wary of them and still shuns them, even though they've left. So now they're standing out, you know, on a limb by themselves with no one to support them.
Now, tell us a little bit about the documentary, because somebody has a question about it. Accidental Courtesy is the documentary. How did this come about?
Well, when the book came out, it generated a lot of publicity, being the first book on the Ku Klux Klan by a black author who sat down and interviewed these people. So a lot of requests to make documentaries and movies and this and the other, you know, ensued. And then finally, I agreed to one of the proposals, and the result was Accidental Courtesy, which aired on PBS earlier this year, and now it's all available on Netflix.
Titus is in Milwaukee, and he has a question for you regarding the film. Titus, thanks for holding on. Welcome. Say hi to Daryl Davis.
Hi, Daryl. How you doing?
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you for calling
I'm
in.
I'm doing great. I loved the documentary. It really struck a chord with me because I could relate to everything you were saying in there. It's something that I've always believed in how we're going to overcome a lot of these things is building these bridges and building these relationships. And through the whole thing, I was just right there with you. But one of the things that stood out is your interaction with the young activists in Baltimore and how that ended up. And the reaction from them was worse than when you sat down with white nationalists, which surprised me. So I was curious if you've made any progress with them or whatever came of that.
Okay, let me tell you. For the listeners who are not aware, the scene that he's talking about is one of the most contentious scenes in the film. I was verbally attacked by a group of members of Black Lives Matter who simply did not agree with what I was doing, accused me of being a sellout, a race traitor, an Uncle Tom, etc., for sitting down with white supremacists and simply just renounced my collecting robes and things like that. What happened was this. If you remember correctly in the movie, the first time the one person met me in the parking lot, first thing he said was, "I understand you're the first black member of the KKK."
Right.
Well, that already, you know, let me know he had been misinformed. He had wrong information. And first of all, if there were black members of the KKK, there wouldn't be a KKK.
It doesn't seem to go together at all.
Right. So he had received this false information, and he had acted upon it without checking it out and verifying it. So then when he got together with his buddies, and it was just me, you know, they ganged up on me and attacked me, and I naturally, you know, defended myself verbally. As a result, it was very contentious, and it was a shame because, yes, they treated me worse than the white supremacists in the movie. However, the upshot of this is that he and I and one of the other ones who was there in the attack, we had dinner together just over a month ago, and the young guy that you're talking about, he's the one who reached out to me and suggested you know, that we get together. And I agreed, and we all had dinner together, and now they understand where I'm coming from. I understand where they're coming from as well, but, you know, when you see a picture of a black man shaking hands with a robed and hooded Klansman, yes, you can have a visceral reaction,
sure.
Like, you know, what the heck is going on here? And then there are those who will have that visceral or knee-jerk reaction and form their own opinion and go along with that. And then there are those who will read the backstory and say, you know, let me find out about this, you know, what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
And then they say, oh, I get it. Now I understand. So that's what's happened over time. You know, they've heard more about me. They've investigated more about me, read more about me, and now they understand. So we have agreed to work together. They do what they do best to fight racism. I do what I do best to fight racism, and we work together. So we had dinner, and all's good now.
Very good. Titus, thank you for the call.
You know, it takes dialogue.
I'm very happy
dialogue,
to hear that.
Sitting down and conversing with one another to reach that point.
Daryl, can you hang on through the news? There's a couple more questions I want to ask you, and time flies because the story is so fascinating. Daryl Davis is my guest. He is the author of Clandestine Relationships. He's the subject of the documentary Accidental Courtesy, and he is one of the speakers at TEDx Naperville, which is happening Friday, November 10th at the Yellow Box Theater in Naperville. Go to TEDxNaperville.com to get all of your tickets and get all the information about all the wonderful speakers. More with Daryl on the other side of the news. We'll do that right after this on WGN. TEDx Naperville is taking place Friday, November 10th at the Yellow Box Theater in Naperville. More than 12 people, all sorts of different people with wonderful ideas coming in to share those ideas with the community. One of the people coming in, Daryl Davis, is the author of the book Clandestine Relationships. He is also the subject of the documentary Accidental Courtesy. He's a race relations expert, and he's been hanging out. We've been having a fascinating conversation to this point. Daryl, thanks for waiting during the news.
My pleasure.
Because I want to ask you now, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been having these conversations for over 20 years. And before that, you said you came up with the burning question when you were 10 years old. So this is a lifelong pursuit for you. Where do you think we are at this point in time in this country as far as race relations go?
Well, you know, a lot of people say we're at a very low period, a very bad period. While this can be viewed that way, I see it another way. I see it as being at a great period in our time right now, despite all the things that are happening racially in our country. And the reason being is because now we're at a point where people are beginning to talk about this, and their desire to address this issue and set it right, you know, has come about. We still have a ways to go, but in the past, people have put a taboo on the conversation of racism. Oh, let's not talk about that. You know, put it under the carpet, keep it in the closet, that kind of thing. Now we're being forced to address it as a result of, you know, things that happened in Charlottesville recently and other, you know, racial hate crimes and things like that. So now we're beginning to talk about it. And so I say we're at a good point.
And when something like Charlottesville happens, and we see things that we haven't seen out in the open for a while, we you know, a lot of people have suspected, and rightfully so, that those feelings are there. There's still people in these groups. There's still very active hate groups in this country. But to see it brought to the forefront and no shame and no trying to hide anymore, does that make you optimistic that things will get better because now we have to talk about it, as you said? Or does it scare you a little, like, boy, this might be deeper than I thought?
No, it's not deeper than I thought, because I've been in this for 30 years.
Sure.
I've seen it up close. I know exactly what's going on. It's a lot deeper than most Americans have thought. Now, let me give you an example. For example, you know, we talk about Charlottesville. The reason why the hate groups, or so to speak, hate groups were there to have a rally. What were they there for, as far as
Confederate statues?
The Confederate statue. Okay, that is absolutely untrue. You know, that's what we're told by the media. The reason, now, I know some of the people who were down there personally. The reason why they were there was to incite the beginning steps of a race war. And let me explain something to you. The Robert E. Lee statue had nothing to do with that protest whatsoever. Yes, there are people in the South and in Charlottesville, certainly, who want to preserve the statue and don't want it removed.
Right.
But the organizers of this particular rally were not there for anything to do with the statue. And let me give you two reasons. Reason number one, they claim that they are the descendants of great, great, great ancestors who fought on the side of the Confederacy, and they want to preserve their heritage by leaving the Robert E. Lee statue in place. So anytime you're going to occupy a public space, whether you want to have a rally, a sit-in, a march, whatever, or sell lemonade and hot dogs in public, you have to have a permit.
Sure.
So you go to the city, you get an application, you fill out your name, and you state your reason. You cannot very well state on the application, well, I want to start a race war.
No, probably not.
You're not going to get a permit for that, right? So you put down some quasi, you know, legitimate reason, like I just gave you. You know, it's your heritage, you
sure
have to serve it, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so fine. You get the permit. And then once you get the permit, you do whatever you want to do. All right, so permit in hand. Now, anybody who knows American history knows that there were blacks and there were also Jews who Mm-hmm. All right, that's a historical fact. Slaves had to fight for their slave masters. They were often Jewish slave owners, some who did not want to give up the free labor, and so they fought to preserve slavery on the side of the Confederacy. Okay, fine. There are descendants of those people who are still around today, black and Jewish descendants of ancestors who fought on the side of the Confederacy. And some of those descendants also want to preserve their heritage in honor of their great ancestors. I know some black people right here where I live who are friends of mine who have joined organizations such as Sons of Confederate Veterans and things like that. They're not anti-black or anti-Jewish or anything like that. They're simply honoring their ancestors.
Okay.
My ancestors are from Virginia, and I'm a descendant of slaves. So, yes, I had ancestors, too, who fought on the side of the Confederacy. However, I honor them because without them I wouldn't be here. But I do not support the heritage of the Confederacy. Okay, so if somebody else wants to do that, that's fine. Now, if that was the reason why they were going to Charlottesville to preserve that statue, why not invite some of their counterpart black and Jewish descendants to march with them?
Good
would
question.
Would that not add more credibility to their cause? Because you would have blacks and Jews also saying, hey, you know what? That's part of our heritage, too. Let's leave that statue alone. Leave it where it is.
Right.
But instead of inviting black and Jewish counterparts to march with them, because after all, whites, blacks, and Jews fought together in the Civil War on the side of the Confederacy. And instead of inviting them to march together, they excluded them, and they marched through the campus of University of Virginia and down the streets of Charlottesville with their tiki torches yelling anti-Semitic and anti-black epithets. So therefore, it wasn't about heritage.
Right.
It was about hate. It wasn't about the statue. That's number one. Number two, these great, great, great descendants of those ancestors, while they want to honor their great ancestors, at the same time, they are dishonoring their closer-in ancestors, such as their fathers, mm-hmm. their grandfathers, and their great-grandfathers. Because, you know what, none of those people who gathered in Charlottesville ever met any of their ancestors who fought in the Civil War. Those people were long dead before these people were even born.
Right.
Okay, but if you still want to honor them, that's fine. However, you do know your father. You do know your grandfather. If you're lucky enough, you might have met your great-grandfather. And you were dishonoring those people because these people fought in World War II and gave their lives or lost arms and legs in World War II. And who were they fighting in World War II?
The Nazis.
The Nazis. So how do you honor your great-great ancestors and then dishonor your closer-in ancestors by marching down the street with people wearing swastikas espousing the very same views that your father, grandfather, and great-grandfather went to war against?
Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Exactly. So, and the Nazis had nothing to do with Robert E. Lee or the Civil War. Hitler wasn't even born at the time.
Correct.
So you see, it had nothing to do with the statue. It all had to do with hate.
So the hate has been there, and it's not going away. It's more out in the open. Do you think, now there's been a lot of talk that the current political climate is emboldening these groups and this type of behavior. In all your years of doing this, do you agree with that? Do you disagree? Is it playing some part in it?
Yes, it is emboldening the behavior. Now, people who want to say, you know, racism is on the rise, da da da. No, I won't say it's on the rise. So, you know, these people have always been there.
Right.
The acts of racism are on the rise. We're not getting a whole wave of new racists. You know, they've always been there.
Yeah.
You know, yes, it may be, you know, we got a few more, you know, new faces, new players in the game, but not by leaps and bounds. The people who promulgate this have always been there, but now they are feeling that they have carte blanche to act out and you know, come out publicly and do these things because of the fanning of the flames here with our current political climate. So the acts are on the rise, but not the membership.
You mentioned before when we were talking about the film Accidental Courtesy that you had some initial disagreements with some of the folks in Baltimore in the Black Lives Matter movement, and that they they misunderstood what you were doing. And there's different ways of approaching the fight against racism. When there are people, and you, I'm sure you hear this, oh, well, you know, what about the violence that's coming out of these groups that are protesting? When you're protesting against something, is it possible to go too far? I mean, you have to get your point across.
Of course it's possible to go too far. You know, and violence is never a an option unless, you know, you are personally being attacked violently and your life is in danger. I disagree with those protesters who went down there and attacked the white supremacists and all that. You know, you cannot beat hate out of someone.
That is,
you
true.
Know, that's just impossible. And I'll tell you what it's like. Let me make an analogy here. It's like another thing, you know, which I hate, is dog fighting.
Right.
You know, and you know what people do who dog fight, they get a dog who already has a disposition of being mean, such as a Rottweiler, a pit bull, or something like that. They mm-hmm. they get that dog, and what do they do with it? They beat it and beat it and beat it and make it more mean and make it more aggressive. And then once they got it all pumped up, they stick it in the cage with another dog to fight to the death.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what was going on down there in Charlottesville. And as a result, you saw people who were already predisposed to being mean and hateful,
right.
And then they are attacked by other people being mean and hateful, and that pumped them up. And what did it do? It resulted in the death of Heather Heyer.
Yes. All right, so what can we do? You've been on the front lines for decades.
What we can do is exactly what I've been doing for 30 years, is invite the opposition to the table to sit down and have a conversation. Too often we form these groups, like, you know, whatever the topic is, hot topic, let's say abortion or nuclear weapons or gun rights or you know, or racism, the statue, mm-hmm. whatever, Confederate flag, all these hot topics. You know, you're going to be on one side, I'm going to be on the other side. And then, so I'm going to form my group, you know, that opposes what, you know, what you stand for. And I find like-minded people to join my group. And then we meet the second Wednesday of every month and sit around and talk with each other about how bad things are, or, you know, with your group. And so everything I say is being reflected back to me by my membership.
Right.
So in other words, I'm in an echo chamber, I'm preaching to the choir, and nothing's getting done. Nothing gets done until I call you up and say, Cody, you know, I don't agree with you, but I want to invite you over to my meeting, and I want you to explain to my membership why you feel that way. You know, I'm not here to fight you. You know, let's not have a debate. Let's have a conversation. Come over here and explain to us so we will better understand your point of view. And when you do things like that, there's an excellent chance that that attitude will be reciprocated, so you will have an opportunity to present your point of view. And people may not change immediately, just like the people in the movie who attacked me. You know, they didn't change immediately. It was like a year later. So, you know, the dialogue is the key. When two enemies are talking, they are not fighting. They're talking. They may be yelling and screaming in disagreement, but at least they're talking. It's when the talking ceases that the ground becomes fertile for violence. So you always want to keep the conversation going. And what I see too much of today, which has to change, is this. People are talking about each other, or talking at each other, or talking past each other. What I'm doing is I'm sitting down and talking with each other, and that is the key.
Well, Daryl, I've enjoyed speaking with you tonight, and I know people will enjoy hearing you at TEDx Naperville. Go to TEDxNaperville.com. TEDx Naperville is happening Friday, November 10th at the Yellow Box in Naperville. Go watch Accidental Courtesy on Netflix. Pick up Clandestine Relationships. Daryl, it has been wonderful speaking to you tonight, and I hope to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
Take care. That's Daryl Davis. You can get all his information, DarylDavis.com. Listen to the music, everything, everything. So very interesting. Let's do this, Cody, and then you have something. Since we're talking about social issues. Cody has something, and I don't know how it ties in with video games, but it does. We'll talk about that in a minute on WGN. We talked a little about the wedding. Again, we will be talking about Cody's wedding at length on the podcast that we're going to be recording that will run next week. We'll drop it right at 6 o'clock when this show usually airs. Why isn't this show airing? Talk to the Blackhawks. They like to play hockey on Sunday. And we like the Blackhawks, so we will... but we also like you, and we know you want to hear new stuff. So we will have a new podcast for you every week when the Blackhawks play during this time period. Okay. So the wedding was great. We know that. I'm realizing I shouldn't have worn pants with a waistband because of the surgery. We've learned that. We've also learned that although I thought I didn't like mac and cheese with gorgonzola, giardiniera, and steak bacon, I'm down. 100%. I'm in. Now, you are involved. And so you're not basking in newlywed bliss. You're actually doing something next Saturday to help humanity. How can this be? Is this the new Cody that we could expect? Now that you're married, you're going to help humanity? You're going to reach out across the internet and try to save people?
I mean, I will help humanity, but of course it's going to be a little bit self-serving.
And sure.
I did have the wife sign off on it. Oh, God, I swore I would never say the wife.
The wife. I had the wife. The old ball and chain?
Oh, God.
The better half?
Yeah, the old ball and chain there.
The ball and chain gave you the okay?
My girl. She's my girl.
Did she pick out that shirt for you, too?
I picked this one out.
But I was going to compliment it either way.
Well, wow.
Don't get so defensive.
What's the
Relax.
New Brian? Look how positive you are.
Well, my gallbladder held all my hate.
Oh.
And that's gone.
It was.
Yeah, I'm working on a new organ because I got a lot of hate, so I needed a bigger organ. The gallbladder wasn't big enough. I'm going liver.
Yikes.
The liver is going to hold all my booze and my hate.
Yikes.
It's going to be very crowded in there.
Yeah.
I might need dialysis just to drain out the hate.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, what are you doing?
So, you know how some people raise money when they run marathons?
Sure, me.
Walkathon.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is.
By the mile.
JDRF walk, stuff like
sure,
that.
Sure, all of that.
Yeah, you go on Facebook, you say, people, hey, I'm raising money for...
St. Baldrick's.
Yeah.
People shave their heads. Yeah.
All these things.
Yeah, yeah.
So, video games do that, too.
Is that right?
That is right.
How is that possible?
There is a charity organization called Extra Life, and every year they have a day, which happens to be this coming Saturday, November... What day is it? November 4th. I probably should have pulled that up.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd have all the information.
There we go. So if you can't make
delighted.
It... Look, we're rusty.
we took a whole week we weren't here, and now we forget how to do this. November 4th is Saturday. You're doing some fundraiser.
November 4th,
you play video. It's a video game-a-thon?
Extra
is that what
Life,
it is?
It is a 24-hour video game marathon.
Wow, so you have to play the whole time?
Well, here's the thing.
How does it work?
I actually have to be in Rockford on Sunday, so I have to... Because I'm going to be at my niece's baptism.
Oh, very nice.
So I can't play the full 24 hours, but I am with my co-host of Game Life Balance US.
Oh, I met John. Sure,
yeah,
very nice guy.
John at WGN Plus. We are going to return our gaming podcast to WGN Plus starting now that the wedding craziness is over.
Okay.
And we're going to kick it off by streaming. Doing a live stream of us playing video games for 8 hours this Saturday, and we're going to do it to raise money for our respective children's hospitals. He's raising money for a children's hospital in Minnesota. I'm raising money for a children's hospital of Illinois, and 100% of the proceeds go there.
How about the proteins? What percentage of the proteins?
Some of the proteins.
All the proceeds.
Yeah, all the proceeds, okay, some of the proteins. Great. But in 2016, Extra Life raised almost $10 million for children's hospitals.
Is that right?
Yeah, that 50,000 gamers participated. The year before that, they had 55,000 gamers raised $8 million. So over the years, they've raised $20 or $30 million for children's hospitals.
Is it because they know that all that Mountain Dew and Cheetos is going to lend you people in the hospital?
It could be. It's all branches of Children's Miracle Network hospitals. It was formed in 2008 to honor someone who is suffering from acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Originally it kind of started out as gamers would send video games to these children's hospitals.
Okay.
Because if you've got to stay in a children's hospital
sure.
for several months,
oh, that'd be horrible.
You have something to do, too, and, you know, fun is a good
way. Yeah, people love kids love video games.
So, yeah. So I've got a donation link that I've been putting on Twitter and Facebook. I'll also post a link on this.
Yeah, share it on the show page.
On the show page and
please.
On WGNRadio.com when I post
nice.
This. So if you're not on social media, you can still go to today's podcast after tonight's show and click the link there. But
so do we sponsor you by the hour? Is it a one-time donation?
It's just a one-time donation.
Okay.
You can set up a recurring donation to Children's Network Hospitals, but for my particular participation, it's just going to be a one-time donation.
Now, is this, I have to ask logistically, One, I think it's a great cause. Everybody should donate something. Two, logistically, for 8 hours, are you allowed bathroom breaks? Do you have to take your GameCube in, or your Game Boy, whatever you play it on, your TV? Do you have to take that into the bathroom with you? Do you have to use a jug? Does your wife have to witness this horror show? How, I have a lot of questions about how this is going to work.
Well, she's the one that's going to be switching out my chamber pot.
The chamber pot. Well, that makes sense, a chamber pot, sure.
Mm-hmm. We had a sword at the wedding, and we had
to, of course. Yes, you did.
There's a podcast. Tease.
Yep. Oh, I like that tease.
But we're going to be live streaming it because we stream stuff now on Twitch TV. So you can follow me on Facebook or on Twitter or social media, and you can actually watch John and I do commentary, supposedly hilarious commentary on these games all day Saturday.
And do you pick the game or do they tell you what to play? So you can play whatever?
We can play whatever we want. We're planning a couple different PC games right now.
Okay, so it's not... not one game for 8 hours, or is it one game for 8 hours?
It can be. Some people do that, but we're going to do a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Little this, little of that.
Yeah, can I switch it up?
Well, good luck with that. It sounds like a wonderful cause, and it's right up your alley. You'd be playing video games anyway. Now you get to help the world doing it.
Oh, next year I'm doing the 24-hour version.
That, I can't wait. That'll be horrific. I weep for your newlywed wife. All right, let's do this real quick. That is news time, WGN. I haven't seen you since a beautiful day on Lake Michigan when we watched young Cody walk down the aisle and marry his beautiful bride.
I can't tell you how happy I am to see you well, and I can't tell you how happy I am to see Cody still married.
Yeah, it's been a week. He hasn't succumbed to the 7-day itch.
It was a beautiful wedding, really beautiful. And really, if that day hadn't been the way it was, it could have been a little bit of a disaster, but it was perfect.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how they wrangled a 75-degree day on October 20th.
It was very California, I'll tell you that.
It was beautiful. And the lake, the skyline couldn't look better. The city represented itself well.
Yep.
And you had made Jerry wear pants. They weren't jeans, which was terrific.
And you did a great job as the officiator.
Efficient, yes.
Efficient.
I'm a minister now. I don't know if you know that.
I do know
Because I had to sign. That's how I had to sign the certificate.
I feel very blessed to be here.
Well, sure, you should. how do you think I survived the last week? I just kept blessing myself.
Wow.
Every glass of water I had, I blessed it, threw it right in my face. I was hoping
for
everything.
Well, you look good.
Thank you.
Glad to have you
back.
Thank
you. It's good to be back. So a lot is going on. And I know this is all theoretical about tomorrow, and I know we hadn't talked about this, but supposedly some indictments are coming out tomorrow. And this is not a partisan thing. The indictments are coming. That's the fact. There's no way to know, correct, what might be in those, but explain when a grand jury says yes, okay, how does this process work that now we may be hearing something tomorrow?
Sure. Well, the grand jury is hearing evidence on an ongoing basis. So whenever they get subpoenas back or they get witnesses that they think have testimony, the grand jury is sitting and hearing these things. And at one point, the U.S. Attorney's Office will say, do we have enough evidence for you to bring these charges? And apparently they had reached at least one person.
Okay.
So there are different ways to do this. Sometimes a grand jury will sit and indict a bunch of people all at the same time.
Yeah.
But this is sort of like, it looks like it's going to be a rolling indictment, which means as they come along and as the jurors decide that there's cause, they're going to issue those indictments and then arrest those people.
And is this Mueller's call to do it this way, or is this just the way some investigations pan out?
It's really just the way some investigations pan out. And sometimes the lower people are indicted first, and what happens then is they get those lower people to flip on the higher people up the food chain. And you see that a lot. We've seen that a lot in Chicago with the politicians, where they go for the underlings first.
The aides.
Those people are charged, they get their lawyers, and they cut a deal that says if they testify truthfully, then they get a break on their sentence.
Okay. So that... If you were a betting woman, would you bet that that's kind of how this is going to go? Maybe start with some lower level people in hopes that they will flip?
I do think that. And let me just say one thing about the politicization of it. I can't say the reason that everyone is talking that it's politics. The U.S. Attorney's Office, I don't care where it is, really, those people are not super politicians. They just aren't. They may vote one way or the other. They may have been nominated by one party or another. But these are people who really try to do a very good job and get to the truth. This is not a political process. This is not a political prosecution. I know it will be made out as such, but It's not. And what we're going to see are going to be the facts. These U.S. attorneys will not indict people unless there's not only reason to believe a crime was committed and the person committed the crime, but that there's beyond a reasonable doubt of evidence, which is a high standard.
So they're not going to file charges and indict somebody if there's a chance they're going. I mean, obviously there's a chance they could always lose, but they're going in with their...
Brian, they just don't lose. If you read the newspapers, when you see an acquittal in the federal court, it's very, very unusual. So, you know, I would
they're
guess my the conviction rate in the U.S. Attorney's Office might be 98%. Well, they've got all of the power of the FBI. They've got all their investigators. This is a big investigation. They've got a great panel of lawyers who are doing this investigation. They're getting to the bottom of things.
Is this one of those there? We're all anticipating a lot of names coming down the pipe. Are we going to hear if names come up that were not indicted, or does that never get released?
It probably won't be released. At some point, the grand jury transcripts might be released. But no, I don't think that's the case. I think we're going to hear, who the charges are against, and those people, I don't know if they're going to let them come in on their own, or they're going to actually go out and arrest them. Normally speaking, they call an attorney, and they say, you know, you can either come to the office, and we'll, you know, fingerprint you and do all those things. Or we'll come out and arrest you. So it'll be interesting to see who this person might be.
Now, we've heard different things coming out of the White House, and I wanted, because anytime we mention the administration, people get up in arms. So let's take it out of there. Let's say it's a company, all right? And the CEO of this company, there's some investigations, and there's word that indictments are coming, and the CEO claims he will pay the legal bills for everybody that is going to be... Is that allowed? Does it throw the case, make the case harder for the defense or the prosecution if everybody is under the same, you know, if President Trump is paying for everybody's defense, is that going to screw up the deal?
No, I think that, well, a lot of times companies will do that because they want to make sure that everyone is properly represented because they don't want someone to flip.
Or is it right? It's buying loyalty.
And they also want for everyone to be on the same page. They don't want one person to say this is what happened in this meeting and another person to say no, that's not the way it worked. And so in paying for the defense, actually each party has to have their own lawyer. You can't have the same lawyer for different defendants in a case like that. There would be a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest. So no matter if they're being paid by the same entity, there have to be different lawyers who have separate obligations.
Okay.
Just because someone's paying my fees, like if someone's mother is paying my fees, that doesn't mean I do what the mother says. I do what my client says.
Okay.
That's your obligation as an attorney.
Okay. Let's go to, imagine you're an attorney. You walk into court and you're ready to talk to the jury, the prospective jurors. You're going to do some voir dire. And all of a sudden you look over, hey, I recognize that guy. He used to be the president of the United States. Barack Obama has been called for jury duty in Cook County.
I love this story.
And he says he's going to show up. There's no way he ever spends a day on a jury, correct?
Well, we don't know. I mean, Bill Clinton was called for jury duty after he served. So was George W. Bush. And do you know that Donald Trump was called for jury duty in New York City 6 times and he never showed up any of the times, except the last time when he was running for president?
Oh, sure.
I just had to say that. but anyway, no, I think it's great that he's coming. I think that it's going to create a huge security problem for the Cook County Circuit Courts. I think it's going to be a circus over there. But, yeah, the chances of him being selected are really low because, obviously, he would probably be the foreperson, and it almost seems unfair. It almost seems like it wouldn't be a fair deal to have a president who's so influential, right?
Yeah.
And who's going, he's not only a president, he's a lawyer, he's a Harvard law graduate, he's a law professor, and of course he's going to have sway with the jury.
Yeah.
If I were a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer, I'd want him on. If I were a criminal defense lawyer, I'd want him on. But I'd also try the case to him. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I would make sure that whatever I was saying was directed directly to his ears and to what I think he wants to hear. Because if he's going to sway the other jurors and he's going to be the foreperson, I want his vote, first and foremost.
Now, we've talked about this before, but again, what kind of people, as a defense attorney, what kind of people don't you want on a jury?
You generally don't want law enforcement people. You don't want people who are very conservative. You want people with an open mind to keep open the idea that someone could be framed or that they didn't commit the crime. You want someone who's not a complete rule follower, meaning if you follow rules and you think all of the rules are good and you never question them,
right,
you're going to listen to the prosecution and think that the person's guilty. So you want someone who can have a little imagination and think that maybe it's not the way the government says it is.
Okay.
People who have a distrust of the government are always good people from the jury. And, you know, and people who have people in their families who may have been convicted of a crime, because they would have some compassion for people who are sitting on the other side.
Okay. Very interesting. Karen Conti is here, 312-981-7200. That's how you get your questions in. We have some coming in on the text. Feel free to call. Get your questions in early, because you wait till last minute and then Karen's gone and you cry and we, you know, there's nothing we can do about it till next week. All right, let's do this. Then we'll be back. More with Karen on the other side, 720 WGN. Let's go right to the line. Lauren is in Libertyville. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. What's your question for Karen?
I'm wondering, my husband has full custody of my stepkids, and he and I are having some problems lately. I don't think he's real receptive to me at this point of getting guardianship. However, I feel that I am by far the better parent. I'm wondering, I mean, how, if we have had possession of the children for 2 years and I have been the primary caregiver, what are my chances?
That you want to have the children instead of him?
Correct.
You're probably not going to get that, because the law presumes that the biological parents are fit unless there's some real good reason why they're not. So he's going to get the children. Now, the question is, will you have visitation rights and rights to parenting time with the children? And I think you will. Hopefully that will be done by agreement. I would hope that your husband would, you know, agree to that. Do you think he will do that?
I don't know at this point. He's having some mental issues and been off of his medication. So he is very paranoid at this point.
This is a tough situation, and you're in a tough spot, because I'm sure that you bonded greatly with these children, and I believe you when you're telling me that you're a good parent and maybe even closer in some regards than your husband. But your rights are going to be, unless you can prove he's unfit, and then there might be other people who would come in, like grandparents or aunts and uncles who are related, who might be seen to have superior rights. But if you want to discuss this with me further, why don't you give me a call or email me? I've got a new email address.
Yes.
And maybe we can sort out what your issues might be.
What's that number in that new email address?
Sure. My number is 312-332-7800. And the new email address, which I hope is easier, is wgn@askkarenconti.com.
Okay.
All right.
Good luck, Lauren.
Thank you very much.
Take care. This question came in a while ago, right after we started. I was threatened into co-signing on a car. How do I get out of it? I'm scared. Please help.
And do we have any other information?
That is all the information, unfortunately.
Now, what she's talking about is the concept of duress. If you sign something under duress, you can get out of the contract. It's void. However, duress is very hard to prove.
Okay.
Duress has to be something like almost a gun at your head. Mm. It can't be, I'm going to divorce you if you don't sign for this car, or I'm going to hate you for the rest of your life, or even I'm desperate. I need this car to make a living and earn my pay. No, that's not duress.
Right.
So I don't know that you're going to be able to get out of this contract using that excuse.
Okay.
That's a, you know, before you sign, co-sign a loan, before you co-sign for a car, really think about it, because you're on the hook.
Right.
You're on the hook. If that person doesn't make a payment, it's you and it's your credit.
Karen is here, 312-981-7200. Give us that new email address again.
Sure. It's wgn@askkarenconti.com. And that's C-O-N-T-I.
Let's go to Cal City. That's where Antonio is. Hi, Antonio.
Hello.
What's your question for Karen?
Okay, I work at the University of Chicago, and I have the Aetna insurance. When the university sent a bill to Aetna, they refused to pay until I told them if I have another insurance. Should I? Is it any of their business if I have another insurance or not?
Yeah, I think they have an absolute right to ask you that, because if there's sometimes people have a primary insurance and this might be a secondary insurance, or maybe your wife has insurance that you're covered on. So yes, they need to know that before they process it. There's probably some fine print somewhere that allows them to ask you that question and get that information. So I don't think that's something you should fight about.
Yeah. All right. Good luck, Antonio.
Good luck.
Yeah, that's, I mean, just in the last last week, I've been going through a lot of that. Where,
sure.
Is this your only insurance? Yes. Do you have other? No, I don't have other insurance.
No, it's
insurance.
A standard question that they ask. Because sometimes other things are covered by the insurance. That's
right.
The other thing, you know, that maybe one policy covers something that the other one doesn't.
Exactly. From the 708, what is the best way to make out a will when a parent does not want one of the children to be able to protest the will? Only asset is a house. Thank you very much.
I'm not an estate planning lawyer, so I would say you want to go to somebody who is an estate planning lawyer and get this done. I'm not going to give you specific advice, but there is you could put the house in the name of the child as well. Maybe, I don't know, children or child, so that when the parent passes away, the children will automatically be on the title, and therefore there will be no need to have a will or really have anyone contest the will.
And they can, if, let's say we're all there and you put my name on your house, but not Cody's, well then Cody has no, he can't, can he contest it?
No.
No.
No, I mean, unless he wants to contest the fact that the house was transferred.
Okay.
And if there's undue influence, or if the parent is maybe, you know, not in sound mind, that can be contested. But it's probably a clean thing to do to just put it in the names of the people who are the beneficiaries. Now, there could be other assets and other debts here in this case.
Sure.
And that advice may not be sound if those other things are in place. So definitely talk to a estate planning lawyer, and I can definitely give you a good name of somebody in your area.
And it's always we get the questions that have there's family drama all the time. Somebody's
yes.
being left out, somebody's not this, somebody's not that. And you brought up undue influence. We've talked about that before, where if you have an older parent and they may, you know, maybe they're under medical care, maybe they're not altogether with it, you don't want it to look at all like you're going in and convincing them to do something. And that can be very tricky, especially if the parent is like, I need you to find me a new lawyer. I need you to do this for me.
Well, and think of this. If there's a contest, it's going to happen when the parent dies, so there's no witness on that side.
Right.
So it's going to be your word against, you know, nobody.
Right.
And the idea that you maybe choose the lawyer, you're doing a favor to your parent, but you're choosing the lawyer. You're taking the person, your parent to the lawyer's office.
Right.
Maybe you're even going to go in and sit there and listen and put your two cents in. All of those things would seem like the responsible thing to
sure.
do when you're a child of an adult parent, but that does not work well, because that could definitely be deemed to be undue influence, which would undo whatever estate plan there is.
All right, there was a big award recently, $44.7 million. A man won this award because the judge or the jury found that this cop shot a guy while he was off duty.
Yes.
And it's been going on for a while. The jury awarded a guy from Morgan Park $45 million, pretty
huge
much.
Huge verdict.
Officer Patrick Kelly fired the bullet into his skull in 2010, misled investigators that it was a suicide attempt. Michael Laporte is the man. He can't walk or read. He'll require round-the-clock care, but said he's glad it's, quote, finally over. The big news on this took 20 minutes. For the jury to come back with this award, that seems very quick. So did the prosecution do a good job proving their case, or is this just anti-cop, and is the award in line?
It's a remarkably fast jury. Generally speaking, you know, there's some rules of thumb about how long jurors will deliberate, you know, maybe, you know, several hours for every day of testimony, because they want to go back there and they want to at least have people think that they considered all the evidence and,
right.
and they thought about it. Here, it was pretty egregious, and the fact that the police officer covered it up and actually tried to, I think in this case, claim that the guy tried to commit suicide, which really angered the family and probably angered the jurors. But this is still a remarkably quick verdict, and for that amount of money, which is a huge amount of money, probably necessary because
right.
of his injuries over the next, you know, 30 or 40 years, he's going to incur those costs. I still think it was a very, very quick jury.
Now, the city's lawyers said, well, it was that fast. This is easy to appeal. Now, of course, the guy who won the judgment, his attorney said, well, let him go ahead and appeal. It's
I
not
think they already
change.
Did. If I thought yeah. I just saw it yesterday that they did file an appeal.
What would be the grounds for appeal?
You know, that the judge made a mistake, let evidence in that he shouldn't have. I think there was evidence in this case that the police department has a pattern and practice of covering things up and that this is all part and parcel of the problem. And maybe they're going to argue that that shouldn't have been brought up because what happened on this occasion really had nothing to do with the history of the police department and happened after the fact. Okay. So maybe that's a ground for appeal. Could also be that they're arguing the damages are excessive, although in a case like this, I don't think they would be.
Yeah. Karen Conti's here. You have a legal question, 312-981-7200. Same phone number, but give us that and give us this brand new email address because we're already getting texts going. Is it two @s? Is it WGN@KarenConti.com? So
sure.
Nice and slow.
The email is WGN@AskKarenConti.com, and that's Karen, KarenConti, AskKarenConti.com, and my phone number is 312-332-7800.
Get your questions in. More with Karen on the other side of the news, WGN. Okay, Lisa Madigan, not running for Attorney General again. She's done a good job, in my opinion, up to this point. Former Governor Pat Quinn saying he may run for Attorney General. Is a former politician who's he didn't leave office voluntarily, he was voted out.
Right.
Which happens to politicians all the time. Is that a good move? Let's answer that. Is that a good move?
There's a political part of this and a legal part of this. All right. And, you know, since I'm not really a political commentator, I just say that, you know, Pat Quinn loves politics. He wants to
yes.
stay in the game. And a lot of people do this. They want to just keep at some office. Judy Barr lost the governor race, and then she stepped down from her treasurer job and then took a job as comptroller, which was,
right.
you know, so they want to stay in the game because that's what their career is. I get it. Here's my thought on this. I think Lisa Madigan did a great job. When she was first elected, I thought to myself, she's too young. She's a political, you know, she's from a political family. I don't think she's going to do a good job.
Right.
And I was so wrong. She did a great job. People there who work for her have all the respect in the world. She's done great things for the consumers of Illinois. And she served her time really, really well. She did not use it as a stepping stone.
Right.
There have been attorney generals in the past. Attorneys general, I guess I should say, who have used it as a stepping stone. They're a figurehead. They let their lawyers do their stuff. They let the administrators run the show, and they sit there and they take credit for all that's going on. Lisa Madigan was a hands-on attorney general, and I hope that Pat Quinn, if he is elected, will be the same and that we'll get actively involved in the process and in, you know, policy. I mean, they're really a very important office in Illinois.
There's a lot of interest in this office because it is such a powerful office. We hear about the attorney general. We hear about the state's attorney. We hear about the U.S. attorney. Do they all work in concert? What do they each do, and how do they then come together, or do they come together?
I think it's a good question because a lot of people confuse them. The Cook County State's Attorney's Office is the DA.
Okay.
They're the prosecutors. They prosecute crimes that violate the state laws. Okay. The U.S. Attorney's Office are prosecutors. They're like DAs, but they prosecute crimes that are federal.
Okay.
Okay. Now, there's crossover because if you commit a drug crime, for instance, that might violate both a state and a federal crime, so they will have to work out who gets jurisdiction because the federal government usually goes for the big gang stuff and the state's attorney will go for some of the more street crimes. The attorney general's office really represents the people of the state of Illinois. They advocate for laws. They enforce the laws. They enforce the environmental laws. They occasionally represent people from the state when they're sued in a civil matter, but generally speaking, they're advocating for consumer rights. They've got elder consumer rights, they've got mortgage division, they've got all these divisions that help people assert their rights in the state of Illinois.
Now, do attorney general, Illinois attorney generals, do they usually get, like, have Lisa Madigan seemed to have a few, for lack of a better term, pet projects, you know, where they go, this is something I care deeply about, and they pursue that. Is that a common thing, or do some attorney generals just come in and they can still do a good job, but they're just enforcing the laws that are already there.
I think that most attorneys general will have that kind of pet peeve thing. You know, they get together with their other cohorts in the country, and they have different policies. They talk about policies. This has worked in this state. This is what we advocated. This is the kind of lawsuit we filed to get money for the people who were medically damaged by smoking. You know, that was a big
right,
one.
Right.
I mean, that was before her time. But so they have these policies that help raise money or that do good for the people. And so, yeah, they will have pet projects. And it's also political, because if they're going to run for office later, they can say, hey, listen, look what we did for veterans. Look what we did for the young people. This is what we did for, you know, mortgage people who are, you know, defrauded by
right.
mortgage. So yeah, they do have their little pet projects.
All right. So, and that's an interesting thing. Before we, I want to ask you about, you know, you had a really good prenup for this one in here. But now that he's actually married, we'll want to talk a little bit about that. But it has been, and this is a horrible anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of the disappearance of Stacy Peterson.
Is it really?
Yes, 10 years.
Wow.
October 28th, 2007 is when she disappeared. That was the last time she was seen. We know kind of the twists and turns of this case. You've worked and observed a lot of crazy, for lack of a better term, cases over the years. 10 years in, what's your take on this whole Drew Peterson thing? We know he's not getting out. He's eligible for parole in like 2081. So he's not getting out.
No, he's going to die in prison now that the Illinois Supreme Court has rejected his appeal. Some people thought that they might reverse it based on the hearsay testimony
right.
that was largely convicting him. And then he's got the other conviction of trying to get somebody to kill the state's attorney.
Well, sure.
In
that
Will
little
County.
Thing?
So,
come on.
So he's got the double whammy. He'll die in prison. There's no question. Will we ever find Stacy Peterson's body? My guess is no. Whatever he's done, he's done a good job. And, you know, he's a crafty guy. I mean, he served in Vietnam and he was in special forces. He was a police officer for years. Apparently he was somewhat of a rogue police officer. He knows people in low places. I think that this is a guy who knew what he was doing and did it the right way. In what I'm saying, the right
no,
way.
I understand.
In the wrong way, but in the right, wrong way.
Right. And the twist that this case has taken over the years. And were you surprised? And does it surprise you when someone who's accused of these crimes and ultimately convicted of Kathleen Savio's murder and this murder fire thing, when they become kind of media darlings? Because for a while, he and his first attorney was a Joel Brodsky.
Yes.
They were everywhere. They were media darlings. Does that surprise you? Does it anger you? Does it, you know, you're in the media and you're an attorney?
You know, the way it was done, in my view, is distasteful. There's nothing funny about a murder. There's nothing that's celebrity about being charged with murder or about your wives going missing.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to go into the media and advocate for your client and say, you know, my client did not do this crime. Let's wait for the jurors to sit before we judge. You know, and that's one dignified thing you can do as an attorney. But when you take it on the road and go on Howard Stern and you go on
and pretty much every show in this town,
and you make fun of what happened, it's just distasteful for Drew Peterson. But I'm not sure I can expect anything from him,
right.
given his history. But the lawyers should really stay out of that fray. It made us look really bad as lawyers.
Yeah,
I really do think that. And I don't know. It's just because you can get on the air doesn't mean you should.
Right. Or if you are, you know, think a little bit more about what it is. But was it Peterson's personality? Who do you think makes that final call? Is that a client makes that call? Or I know as an attorney, you're going to try to advise as diligently as you can. But in the end, do you have to give in to what your client wants?
Well, he could have, Drotsky could have advised Peterson, listen, I'm not going to be any part of this.
Right.
If you want to do this, I totally advise against
okay.
you. I would put it in writing that you are harming your case. You're affecting a jury pool. This, you're not becoming a media darling. You're a laughing stock and you have, there's no sympathy for you at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to be part of it. You could say that. But I find that sometimes lawyers and clients are like, you know, the dog and the owner.
Right.
They start to kind of look and act alike. So I do see that sometimes clients will hire somebody who's like them.
Okay.
And who will represent them in the way they want to be represented. And apparently Drew Peterson wanted to be represented in a circus environment, and that's what he got.
Well, he did get it, and now he's, as you said, he's going to die in prison, and we will never... Like you said, 10 years after 10 years, the chances of finding anything is got to be infinitesimal.
What we'd like to see at the deathbed, confession about.
He doesn't strike me as a guy who ever is going to feel any sort of remorse.
No, but I think he likes to be in control, and people who are sociopaths like to tell people things that they don't. They know everything. You know, Drew Peterson knows everything, and at the end, he might just want to show that he got the last laugh.
That'll be interesting to find out. Hopefully that comes sooner than later. Karen Koch is here. Wow, that was awful. 312-981-7200. That's how you get your questions answered. We are here until 9 o'clock, so get your questions in quick. Richard has been hanging on. He is in Deerfield. Hi, Richard.
How are you, Brian?
Good.
Karen,
hi,
thank
Richard.
You. Just got a quick question. I got a little notice in the mail, bold letters in the little box there. And, hello, I'm going to do this. I know your secret about your wife, and more importantly, blah, blah, blah. $2,000, you don't know me personally, hired me, you know, to look at me and all this kind of stuff. How does this, it's a little form letter, and then it goes to Bitcoin. Okay, so it's all this, doesn't say anything about, you know, what I did or anything like that. Just has my name in there a few times. Option one, you know, sign it, you know, send the money, blah, blah, blah. If not, I'll go to the cops. I've taken every step, you know, trace back to me and all this kind of stuff. And then it has a separate little how-to guide on Bitcoin. What do I do with this?
And you have no idea where this came from.
Well, all I know is the no return address, but it was from Nashville. And I'm in Deerfield.
Did you do anything that you could be blackmailed for?
Brian, I'm thinking about that.
Well, that's,
I've been thinking about that for a long time.
If you haven't, then I would ignore it. That would be.
I mean, it seems
like maybe 40 years ago I've done something, but yeah, I'm 60 years old. You know, no, nothing.
Okay.
Well, you know, I mean, that's really kind of, that's extortion.
Yeah.
That's what it says. At this point, maybe thinking I'll go to the cops, which is why I've taken every step to ensure this letter cannot be traced to me, blah, blah, blah. Won't stop the evidence from destroying your life and looking to break your bank. I just want to compensate it for the time investigating you $2,000 in books on that.
Yeah, I would take it to the police, and, you know, they might send you to some other agency, some federal agency. And my guess is you're not the only person who receives something like this. And they may be able to help you, you know, on how to deal with this. So
the second page, which has nothing with my name on. Every once in a while, they throw my name in this little thing. And then the second page is just the how-to guide about the Bitcoin. How do you do that?
Wow.
It's two pages, and then at the very end, it says, take a deep breath. You are finished.
This is the old school. This is you, because Cody had that happen with all his records on his computer, where they were held hostage, and he had to play Bitcoin. But this is old school, where they're sending it through the mail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a bunch, Karen and Brian, I've gotten a bunch of, you know, the IRS calls and stuff like that, you know, which I did. Make a comment to the very small police department, and I made a comment to them, and they said, they can't do anything about that. It's, you know, they have cell phones, they just get rid of them, and, you know, you're not going to do anything. But I just thought this one, I didn't know. I just thought I would call.
Yeah,
and
I said, because I think that these are sent out in mass, the police are going, you're not going to be the first person who reported this, and that maybe they can help you, you know, so they can refer you to someone who might be able to help you further. Or they might be interested in trying to track it down. Who knows?
All right. Good luck, Richard. Hope it works out for you. Yeah, that's, again, to send something through the mail, though, that's low tech.
So much of that going on in so many different regards. I mean, even like people, I see this in my clients, and my clients have businesses, right? And, and so I need a refund. I really don't like what you did for me 3 months ago. Give me a refund or I'm going to go on Yelp and Better Business Bureau and all this stuff. And it's extortion.
Yeah.
You know, and they go and they do it.
Right.
And, you know, it can hurt people's businesses.
Yeah, ruin your reputation very easily. Karen Conti's here, 312-981-7200. That's how you get your questions answered. We'll take one more quick break. We've got some people hanging on. Get your call in fast, and we'll get to them right after this on WGN. It's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. AskKarenConti.com. So WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Let's get right to the phones. Renee has been hanging on. She's in Chicago. Hi, Renee.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. What's your question?
My question is, I was threatened to co-sign on a car for someone. I've had my phone number for a long time, and this person is pretty bad when I was younger. Anyway, I don't want to get into the details, but he threatened me. He knows where I live. And I had to co-sign on this car. Otherwise, he would have killed me, and I want to get out of it. I can't believe they did it, because I have no credit. I mean, I have zero credit. My number was zero. And I had to go co-sign on this car. Otherwise, I don't know what would have happened. And I want to get out of it, and I don't know how to do it.
Okay, this is the texter from earlier. I asked her to call in.
Renee, this is going to be hard, because did you report any of this to the police at the time?
No.
Yeah.
No.
And I know I'm not blaming you. I know you were too scared. This is really hard. You are probably, you know, the first order of business would be that you'd have to write them a letter and say, this is what happened. I was under duress. He threatened me. I know he has a gun. Whatever the facts are, you'd have to, you know, tell them that and see if they'll let you out. My guess is they're not going to do that. So your next step would be to hire a lawyer to try to have them undo it. And the lawyer might have to actually file a lawsuit to have it declared void based upon duress. So you're going to...
I know this guy's just a drug dealer. And, you know, I don't have the money to, like, move and, you know, somewhere where he can't find me. And stuff like that. So,
well, you know, then you could always get an order of protection against him too. Although that doesn't always help when it comes to people who are not going to follow rules anyway. But if he's threatened you, maybe you should get an order of protection against him.
Okay. And would it do any good to like go to the car dealership tomorrow? I try calling them today and try and get out of it and tell them that it was under duress.
Yes. Do you have any witnesses or any evidence or any emails or anything that would prove
that? No, I don't. I just have a phone, like, that he called me.
Okay. That, you know, go try. It's free. Just, you know, go and tell them your story and see what they'll do. See if they'll help you out. I my guess is they're not going to, but...
And then if not, to the police?
I mean, the police can't get you out of the contract. The police could arrest him for threatening you, but if it happened a while ago, they may not want to pursue that either. But you
No, this just happened on Friday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've been sitting here all weekend not leaving my house.
Was this a new car or a used car?
It was a used car.
Okay.
And
why don't you email me?
It was for his girlfriend or something like that.
I don't think there's a waiting period for this type of thing from a consumer standpoint, but why don't you email me and I'll quickly take a look at the law to make sure that you don't have a right to get out of that contract, okay? Just as a matter of timing, since it happened so recently. And yes, you should go to the police. I guess I thought that it had happened a long time ago. So.
No, this just happened on Friday, and I have not left my house since then.
Okay, well, you should go to the police. You should get an order of protection and email me so I can help you with the legal part of that.
What's that new email address?
It's WGN at AskKarenConti.com.
All right, good luck, Renee. That's a crazy story. Yeah, good luck. Be sure to email Karen and follow what she said and see, you know, we'll see what happens. We've got time for one more. Lance is in Chicago. Hi, Lance.
Hi.
What's your question for Karen?
Hi. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
I have a car issue too. It's not as serious as the last one. I have a car that we had purchased new. The engine went out. I was told a part fell off and went into the piston, so we need a new engine. It's still under the manufacturer's powertrain warranty, but the car manufacturer won't cover it. They won't honor their warranty. It's a five-year warranty, 100,000 miles. We're at 90,000 miles, and our 5 years up next month, like middle of next month. but they just won't honor it. They're claiming the receipts we provided, some of the receipts don't have the VIN number on the receipt. And I said, that's easily addressable. You just have to call the shop, and they can verify that was the car being serviced. But they're just claiming we didn't maintain the engine,
okay.
So they're not on.
So, Lance, and this is for everybody, when you deal with bureaucracy, do what they say. Don't just say, go call, and you can get the VIN number. You're going to write a letter. You're going to say, here are my receipts. Here are the VIN number. Here's the VIN number. Here's I'm making demand under this warranty. Please pay or whatever within 5 days. So you're doing everything in writing, okay? Because when you call, they'll pretend like they never heard from you. They don't know what the VIN number. You didn't comply with the policy. They're using every possible avenue. You've got to get very legal here, which is put everything in writing, okay?
And see. Yeah, and I wasn't sure because so like the service department's saying that it's the car manufacturer because it's the district manager making the final decision, but they won't give me his full name. I'm not sure. Is this a small claims court thing, or do I somehow address this with the car dealership, or is it the manufacturer? I'm a little confused as to who I'm even supposed to be.
Yeah, and I would have to look at everything to read it to see what it says. Does that mean, because sometimes the warranty is handled by one company, right. But then the dealership actually does the work. So it's like you don't know who you're dealing with. I understand
right.
your confusion, but I think you should look at that warranty and you send everything to that warranty company at the address that's listed on it, okay? And then, you know, if you want to send me a quick email, I can maybe give you some advice about how to handle a small claim.
And what's that new email address?
WGN@AskKarenConti.com.
All right, Lance, good luck.
Good luck.
And if people want to give a quick call, the number is?
312-332-7800.
All right, so WGN@AskKarenConti.com. That's Karen's new email address. Use it because, unfortunately, we will not be here for the next 2 weeks.
That's right.
Because the Blackhawks are playing hockey. So, but people can still hear you Wednesday mornings with Steve Cochran at 6:40.
That's right.
And we'll see you in a couple weeks.
All right.
All right.
Take
Hopefully
care.
We'll all still be here.
That's right.
All right, let's do this. Then it's news time and we say goodbye. It's WGN. Thanks for listening and being part of the program. Don't forget, we won't be here next Sunday, but a brand new podcast. Yes, we're back in the podcast game. So the show will drop at 6 o'clock, right when we should be taking the air. You'll be listening to the Blackhawks during the breaks. Listen to all the new content that we will have, the big Cody's wedding recap next week. Rick Hogan comes your way on the other side of the news. Thanks, Roger. We'll talk to you soon. Tuesday night, we're recording, so if you want to come and join in.
I think I will be here. I'm filling in for Esmeralda.
Fantastic. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn, and then realize the machines now run everything. It is a little after 9 o'clock with the news. Roger Battish.